What's up, everybody? It's Lee, otherwise known as Intuition, and you're listening to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in again. Get the social media stuff out of the way real fast. Follow me at It's Intuition on Twitter, on Instagram, all that shit. Follow my man, Ben Shim, behind the boards, making it sound buttery, at I Am Database, base with two S's. He's on Instagram, too. Slangin' Mad Filters. You can follow us as a unit at That's Kinda Neat. I don't really fucking tweet that much from there, so you should just follow it because it's not going to blow up your timeline. It just helps us show that people are listening. Check out our YouTube channel, youtube.com/That's Kinda Neat, and you can find everything in a pretty package at kindaneat.net. It just rolls off the tongue. This week, we have in a dude that I've just been seeing around and that I've heard all like my friends tell me he's a great guy, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, he would be great to talk to, you guys would get along well, and I think we did. We had a really great conversation. His name is Clayton Blaha. He's a mover and he's a shaker and he's an influencer and he's a publicist, and I do like to have musicians on the show, but I also love to have people that are involved in the music industry in an interesting way. And I think that without publicists, a lot of you guys wouldn't know about your favorite artists, because the way that they end up on your favorite blogs or the way that you end up hearing about them in magazines is because of publicists. And so he's really good at his job, and he's an integral part of Skrillex's team and Skrillex's publicity, and you know, we talk about that. We also get really personal, and the conversation is literally heartbreaking at times, and it was just really good. So I'm excited for you guys to hear that. I've been getting a lot of great questions to give advice on, and I have one that hits near and dear to me this week. I'm not going to name the guy's name because I don't want to put anybody on blast, but he goes on to ask, hey Lee, I'm a huge fan and listener of Kinda Neat. Thank you so much. I think it's dope that you share your opinions and life stories so nonchalantly. That being said, here's my issue. I'm a college student from an upper class family and I've got a lot going for me. Recently, I've started talking to and taking out this girl. Physically, she's everything I could ever want and more, but she's a part-time stripper and go-go dancer. Not in school and has been on her own since she was 16. Needless to say, we are complete opposites. I know my family wouldn't approve at all if they knew her background, which is a big deal because I still live with them when I'm on my breaks. But I really like this girl. What's your opinion on the situation? I love this question. It's a question that hits near and dear to my heart. I have many, many views on exotic dancers, and I too have dated an exotic dancer in the past, and I too was very conflicted about it, and I didn't quite know how to handle the situation other than getting out of it, which was the choice that I decided to make. But first and foremost, I want to say that there are different types of exotic dancers. There are dirty strippers, and those are the ones that secretly take money to do extras, as they call them. And there are clean dancers who don't do that sort of shit and look down upon those girls. And there are girls who are literally just putting themselves through school to do it. And then there are girls who, that's the lifestyle they live. Surefire sign to know whether or not you're dating a dancer is when she tells you that she cocktails at a strip club. Because if she says she cocktails, that means she actually is a dancer. There's no girl that will admit that she's a cocktail waitress at a strip club. That's just to hide the fact that they are actually dancers. I don't think that dancers or strippers are inherently bad people. Like, I think they are just women that have grasped the power of the pussy. It's a very powerful thing. And honestly, guys, if women would pay to fucking see your cocks, all of us would be doing it. You know what I mean? Like, that is a powerful motive to try and make money, to be able to be a hustler and to embrace that power and utilize it. I personally think it's kind of a feminist thing. I don't think it's derogatory if done in the proper context. But on the other hand, some women just don't want to do anything else, or perhaps can't do anything else, and that's what they get into. The girl I dated began doing it after we started dating, and I wasn't happy about it, but I dealt with it, and it was hard to deal with. It's hard to think about the fact that a girl you're seeing is getting seen naked by other dudes, and it's hard to hear about her telling you about the other girls at the club that do perform extras and, like, creepy guys that come in and the regulars that want weird shit. It's a weird fucking subculture, man, and it's hard to deal with. And I know that my mom doesn't listen to the podcast, so it's like, whatever. Like, I never told my mom that this girl was a dancer, and this was a while ago. She knew that she worked at night, and I just told her, I think I probably told her that she cocktailed, you know? And it's not an easy thing to cope with, and it's not an easy question to answer. And I think that it really lies within how strong your feelings are for this girl. And is your family going to be upset by it? Abso-fucking-lutely, because once you tell somebody that a girl is a stripper, that's all they see in them. And that's a shame because, you know, humans are multidimensional and there are more sides to every person and no one is just a stripper. I'm not just a rapper. I'm a dude who does multiple different things. Yeah, your family's going to be upset, dude. And so if you like her, which it sounds like you do, even though it kind of scares me that you said physically she's everything I could want, because really what you have to worry about is the mental thing that's going on with that, because it does take a certain type of person who has had a certain type of past to hustle in that manner. You know, a lot of dancers are fucking nuts. That's real shit. Those who aren't are probably few and far between. And the fact that you are saying, oh, she's everything I want physically, may mean that perhaps this is just like a good summer fling for you or something. But if you are into her in a mental capacity and you guys get along emotionally, then it just depends on how much you like her. Because if you like her, you're going to do anything to make it work, i.e. you will help her pursue her actual dreams, because I'm sure she doesn't dream of being a stripper and a go-go dancer for her whole life. I'm sure she has other things that she is pursuing in the daytime, because that's a night job. You know what I'm saying? So I'm sure that she has other dreams. And if she does have other dreams and you're from a well-off family, like you're saying, perhaps you will help her to try and reach her other goals or push her in that direction, or not push, but just guide her. You know, if she is trying to accomplish going to whatever, like going to, you know, college, going to some other sort of school, help her do that. If you're from an upper class family, you probably have a good means of like a good understanding. It's like rich dad, poor dad shit. If you're from an upper class family, you probably understand money better than the average person does. You know what I mean? I'm from a middle class family, but thankfully my mom was really great at organizing money or handling money. And so she's like taught me a few things, and I'm not as good at it as her. My brother's much better at it than I am, but I'm not completely fucking ignorant to it. I know how to like check my bank account and make sure I have the right money. But my point is that you probably have a good knowledge about money, and you probably, if you say you have a lot of things going for you, perhaps some of those are starting your own business or what have you. So perhaps you can like try to rub some of that stuff off onto her. It's a tough call though, man. And it can be a deal breaker. And for me, a big part of why I ended it was, yeah, that's a deal breaker for me. It's hard to cope with that. Like, I'm not a completely jealous person, but it's hard not to fucking get a little jealous that like a bunch of strangers get to see the same thing as you. It's different and it's hard. So my advice is follow your fucking instincts. You know what I mean? Not to be too on the nose, but go with your gut, follow your intuition. If you think that this is a serious thing, follow it. Help her. Not that she needs help. That's not what I, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying, oh, she made this fucking terrible life decision. Like, hey man, if you're a dancer, that's your thing. I'm not judging you. I'm not here to judge anybody. But what I'm saying is if it bothers you and you know that she has other dreams, help her pursue those dreams. Be there to support her, and don't act like a fucking raging asshole or, you know, a completely controlling maniac about that. If you think that it is just a fling and you are just into her physically, pull the Band-Aid off immediately. Don't be a fucking asshole and let someone linger in your life for a long time and let them get emotionally attached to you just to pull the Band-Aid away, because it is a really mean and shitty thing to do. And, you know, I've done that in the past and I feel like a shitty person about it. So pull the Band-Aid off quick if you think that it's not made to last. Hopefully that advice was good. Hopefully I didn't reveal too much about my love life or put anyone on blast. But yeah, you know, dating a dancer is tough. And that's from a very real place. And it sounds scummy on the surface maybe, but you know, she was a really fucking good girl and a nice girl, and I don't hold it against her. It is what it is. So yeah, man. That's my advice. Follow your gut and fucking pull the Band-Aid off quick if you think it's just a physical thing, because you don't need – there's plenty of other chicks that you can go out and fuck if it's just a fuck, you know? Yeah. We're going to get right into the conversation with Clayton Blaha of Biz3 and one of the co-owners of Ausla, who works closely, like I said, with a lot of artists that you probably listen to and love. And without any further ado, here's the conversation. So you just moved to LA 6 months ago?
Yeah, I moved to LA because I hated Chicago so much, and I was really ready to do anything to, I don't know, like I wasn't in a position where I was going to, like the team that I work with and my people that I work with are family to me, and they've done so much for me that I can't imagine not working with them, but I hated Chicago also, and it made me a horrible person. It's like totally antithetical to everything that I feel like I hold valuable. So it's basically a soulless pit of sadness for me. And not for everybody. I don't speak on behalf of everybody. I mean, Chicago's a wonderful place. three months out of the year.
You painted it as such a wonderful place.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm an optimist. So I had to get out, and it just wasn't for me. And prior to that, I was living in San Francisco, and I've just always identified as a Californian. And I mentioned that to Sonny Skrillex, who I work really closely with, and he hit this wave a couple years ago, and he needed to gather the troops and kind of reassess and like put everything together, and he really wanted me in LA. And so he was just like, you have to move. And I was like, well, okay, all right. And then my other boss was like, fuck it, I'll open an office out there too.
Tight. So they opened an office just because you wanted to get out of Chicago?
No. It was because she was traveling here so much for Daft Punk's record, and her romantic life brought her out here.
That's very sexy.
It is. People look a lot better. I feel like somebody in Chicago is going to hear this and just be like, what a fucking asshole.
We actually, we don't broadcast to Chicago. We're blocked there.
That's perfect.
So don't worry.
I like that. The geo-blocking.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't hate Chicago. It just wasn't for me. And she felt similarly. She had been there for so long. And this woman's like my mother at this point. So she was ultimately aiming at moving out here. And I think that, my doing so was catalytic, but not the reason by any means.
You're so smart. You're already using all these big words on the podcast. You said antithetical and cataclysmic.
Catalytic.
Oh, catalytic. Yeah. Damn, dude. I need to Google a few things before we continue. But first things first, where are you from then? It sounds like you've lived in a few places since college. I want to mention real quick that you're like really struggling with the headphones because your hair is so nice right now. Like,
yo, my boy.
That is a solid problem to have.
It's because my boy Tim follows me on Instagram. He cuts my hair, and I love the guy, and I feel like I would be doing him if I don't keep it proper. I feel like I'm letting Tim down.
Tim, you've done good.
Thanks, man.
The lineup looks clean.
Yeah, Tim does. Tim's good, man.
So where are you from originally?
I feel like I said, I feel like I've always identified as a Californian. I was born in Arizona. Okay. When I was like 3 weeks old, my
Tucson
parents,
or Phoenix?
Tucson, actually. Okay. At the University of Arizona.
I like Tucson. I'm down.
I've never been. I mean, I was
since
once when I was
a baby.
Born. Yeah.
I don't know. I played a show there. It was fucking awesome. Real, real cool artsy town.
Cool. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Anyhow.
Yeah. So I moved from there, and then I lived in the central coast of California, like Cayucas, Atascadero, Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, and Templeton till I was 7.
Good barbecue up there.
Is there?
Yeah.
Really? Like what?
Santa Maria Barbecue. That's where Tri-Tip comes from, is Central Coast, bro.
Tri-Tip? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I'm putting it down on the places that you live.
Feeling blessed.
Yeah,
enlightened.
Yeah. So you moved from Arizona to California, and California is where you did like elementary school or what?
Yeah, until I was 7. I remember being in California. Some of my distinct childhood memories of California were not being able to wear British Knights to elementary school.
Why?
Because it was like 1989, and
people were getting robbed.
It was a blood thing.
Mm.
And even in like Atascadero, those aren't like big cities, but it was a thing. And I remember you weren't allowed to wear British Knights. You weren't allowed to wear Raiders gear for the same reason. And everybody, and that was like the starter jackets were like the hottest shit.
Oh, yeah.
You weren't allowed to wear starter. And I was super bummed on all that. But then also I was on my like Pacific, like my fucking Maui and Sons swag too. And like the jams with the elastic at the bottom and like hella neon and shit.
Zubaz?
Yeah, exactly.
About that.
Yeah.
That's funny. I'm from Alaska originally. We don't know each other very well, so I'm going to throw that out
there,
even though everybody that listens knows it. But I'm from Alaska, and so starter was the hottest shit up there too, because the parkas were like not only very fashionable but functional.
Yeah.
And I remember like coming down, like I had a Raiders one and an Eagles one, like a real, like the black parkas. And my grandmother actually lives close to the Central Coast in Ojai.
Uh-huh.
We would come down and visit, and we went to Disneyland one year, and it was probably like 80 degrees. And I remember seeing like some gangbanger fools rocking starter parkas. In LA, and I'm like, holy shit, like how are they doing that? It's so hot out. I'm in like a tank top and shit. Like,
but you were so ahead of the curve. Like,
yeah.
You weren't even known.
Yeah, exactly. So we were about that. But anyways, yeah, starters, that's great.
Yeah, it was, and like I was into it, but I couldn't wear it. But I was really into the surfing stuff too. And that was right around the time that my parents got me my first skateboard.
Do you associate a lot of your like phases of your life with fashions that you were going through?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I also always tag it back to skateboarding too. Like skateboarding has been, I think I can say with all honesty, skateboarding is the only thing I've done for my entire life.
Yeah. When did you start that?
That was like 1989, I think, was when I first got my first skateboard. It was a plastic. It's exactly like the pennies that all the kids in LA have now. They weren't called pennies. They were just called skateboards. Like they had them at Kmart and shit. And I had the blue one with the yellow plastic wheels. And I buttboarded down the hill by my house. Everybody that's 28 years old in 2013 has the same story. Like everybody did this. Like, it was like everybody had that skateboard. They all fucking buttboarded, and then most of them got rid of it and like went on to like science and being like a human and shit. But I just kept skateboarding.
Yeah, my first skate was like a big blue monstrosity with like a tail. Mm-hmm. On the top it had like zebra stripes, and then for some reason somebody was karate kicking on, like it had clear,
yeah,
grip,
yeah,
clear,
yeah,
grip tape.
Yeah,
and on the bottom it said Space Junk. It had bright pink bright pink wheels and pink like nose guard, tail guard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The tail guards, like, yeah, that served no purpose. They were actually, they were counterproductive because you wanted to be able to snap farther. It didn't make any sense. And the rails on the bottom for like when
you're trying to ollie one of those things was probably insane.
They weighed as much as like a small.
Yeah, and
like,
I think
like a Yugo.
I think the reason that I stopped skating at such a young age was because I was like, probably because of that skateboard. I was like, I can't figure this motherfucker out.
Yeah, I feel like this was, it was a really discouraging technological era for skateboarding, and it really thinned the herd going into to the early 90s.
Yeah,
because that was a really bad time for like the mechanics of skateboarding. And then also like, and then they went into like, I mean, this is later on, but like then we went into like the fucking bearing cover wheel phase with like 45 millimeter wheels that like that like didn't work either. Like,
yeah,
the functionality,
yeah.
It's really bizarre how like it took skateboarding so long to become like a functional means of transportation. Not even that it is really now. It depends on what city you live in.
Were skate videos your first soiree into loving music? That's what I always hear from skaters.
I mean, dude, yeah. It was like, I mean, 1,000%, absolutely. So like after I lived in California, my parents, when I was 7, we moved to Boise, Idaho, and that's where I, like, we lived together, and they bought a house or whatever, or we rented, and I lived with my cousins for a while, and that was hella weak, because my cousins didn't skate, and they just, like, pissed the bed and shit, and, like, it was just really, it was...
You didn't like to sleep with John, he peed
right,
the bed.
Right. Sean was, like, and now he's, like, so much bigger than me, and he has 2 kids, and he's, like, 4 years younger than me, but back then, dude...
But
like,
Sean, you used to pee the bed.
Yeah, dog. We used to have hella beef. Sorry, my phone keeps buzzing.
It's all right. Put it on silence.
And so when I was in Boise, like, that's when I got really into skateboarding. And because I was in third grade, and I set up a, like, that's when I got, like, a street board with, like, what we were talking about, like, the bearing covers, like, the tiny little wheels,
yeah,
and, like, gull wings. And, like, and then I was watching, I think it was probably Fulfill the Dream was one of my first skate videos that I watched, like, over and over and over and over. And that's a Shorties video. And they had the Jizza song, Pass the Bone. That song was sick. That was my first Wu-Tang moment.
I have a Wu-Tang tattoo.
Do you? I have a UGK tattoo.
It's a carton of cream, and it says Dollar Dollar Bill,
yeah,
y'all.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, yeah. Wu-Tang, holla.
Peas in the pod.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Shout-outs to Boise. Who knew that Boise was so fucking hot in the summers? That shit is crazy.
It's really crazy. It's an extreme weather town. It gets really cold. It gets cold enough to ski and snowboard. I snowboarded a lot when I was a kid. But also then it gets just cold enough to like snow in the city and then remain shitty for like
ugly black,
yeah,
snow,
like 4
like
months, with, but,
yeah,
but no more than
like slush and nastiness.
Yeah. It's the fucking worst, man.
Before we go too far into the history, let's like, tell people what you do kind of while we're still early on, just
okay,
so they're like, cause the reason that I have you on is I think you have a really cool, like, behind the scenes job, and you are one of the people that helps, you help the world find out about music. And one of the things that I like to do on this podcast is not only talk to musicians, but I like to talk to people who have jobs in music. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That aren't necessarily musicians.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. So I'm a publicist. Primarily, I wear a lot of hats these days, but my first foray into the music industry and the job that I do to this day is a publicist. I work for a boutique PR company called Biz3 based in Chicago now, in 2 cities, Chicago and Los Angeles. It's owned and run by a wonderful woman named Catherine Frazier, who is a boss, an amazing mother, an amazing friend, kind of my spirit guide, and she's just a very, very important person in my life.
And for those of you guys tuning in, I feel like a lot of you guys who trust my taste and listen to similar things that I do, most of the artists that you like are on Biz3. Real talk. Like, you guys,
really
are,
nice
you guys are fucking killing it, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's very much due in large part to her curatorial ear and the relationships that she's built in the industry over the years. And that's like really how, you know, I mean, it's her, and then there's this woman, Dana, who's also completely incredible. Another man named Trevor, who's a new dad, and he's a very, very rad dude. There's like 5 of us. There's 6 of us total, I think, 7 of us. It's a tiny little company based in a living room in Chicago. And that is a good deal of my workload at this point. Also, I co-own and run a record label with a DJ named Skrillex, and I'm also his publicist. And we had, there's four partners in the label. Catherine, who I just mentioned, is one of them. And then he obviously is, and his manager are also partners as well. And that's about 2 years old, and we've been doing that for, we've been doing that for 2 years.
And that's called Ausla?
It's called Ausla. I think we just crested 52 releases in 2 years or something.
Wow.
We put out a lot of music. A lot of it's really, really, I mean, it's all fucking amazing, but it's also just been such a great learning experience and wearing like a different hat. And kind of using a different part of my brain. And I get to work with some of the most amazing people that I've had the opportunity to even meet. Like, I get to have them like very intimately in my life, professionally and personally. And that's, you know, its own reward.
That's dope. You seem like you've practiced that answer. That's like a good political, polite answer.
No, I don't have to practice. Cause I don't practice saying it, but I practice thinking it a lot because I do think about it a lot.
And it's like, genuine.
Yeah. And like, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people take the things they have in their life for granted. I mean, that's a global truthism, you know? Like,
absolutely.
If you're listening, there's shit in your life that's hella tight and you probably don't think about it that much.
Yeah, it's like I've been watching The Wonder Years while I do work at home for the last couple of days. And Winnie Cooper was just in this play called Our Town. And she goes, it's like about a girl that dies.
Right.
She's like, does anybody enjoy living while they're alive? Because she's like a dead character. You just sum that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, for lack of a better term, like YOLO, bro. Like, fucking, dude, like do it up, enjoy it. Like, if you're not enjoying it, you're doing it wrong, you know?
I'm loving the theme of this podcast. Sorry, YOLO, bro. Fucking YOLO.
There's going to be, when you go back and listen to this, there's going to be very likely a distinct Drake through line.
I'm a big Drake fan.
That's
too.
Not an accent.
Yeah, people are so surprised to hear that I love Drake, but I fucking love Drake.
I actually
did. He just put out a new song today.
He dropped on a song yesterday.
I'm gonna need to get on the internet.
Yeah, man, the OVO SoundCloud popping off lately. They keep uploading this bullshit from like the dude they signed, Party Next Door. That guy kind of sucks, but whatever. I ride for Aubrey, so you know.
So let's get back to Boise. Yeah.
Okay,
I love that you just started a rap beef on my podcast too.
Sorry,
fuck you, Party Next Door. What's up?
I hope he listens.
Yeah, he probably does. We have like 8 million viewers.
Right,
nah,
sick.
I'm
tight.
Kidding. You're in Boise, and it's fucking nasty there. And your cousin pees the bed.
Yeah, yeah. That was like third grade though.
But you're skating already because you're a third grader.
Yeah, and I was skating a lot. And my folks were together at that point, and they bought their first home. And it was wonderful. And I was skating a lot. I was like learning a lot about marijuana.
In third grade already?
No, that was like when I was 12, I smoked weed for the first time.
Wow, that's an early start.
That's what some people say. But then I definitely know kids that were smoking weed a lot earlier than that, like probably 9. Like it's weird because like it's just like no matter where you are, kids will find a way to get fucked up. Like despite like in Boise, there was like in sex ed, they were like, you're going to get crabs and in like science class or whatever, or like health class, they were like, don't sniff fucking bleach. Cause that's what all the kids were into. Apparently, you know, it's like, they're like, despite what the man was telling me to do, like regardless, no matter where you are, if you live in Compton, you're probably going to start smoking weed around 12.
For sure.
And I feel like that's kind of just like one of those things.
Are you a younger sibling?
I'm an only child.
You're an only child.
I am an only child.
See,
yeah.
I'm an older sibling, and my younger brother started smoking weed when he was 12, but that's because he had a 15-year-old brother, you know
right,
what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's like you have that jump start.
We had – it was a weird situation in my neighborhood at that time. It was like – because I was an only child, I was a total like – I was your friend. I was that friend that's always at your house playing your Nintendo because my parents wouldn't buy me like a Sega or whatever,
mm-hmm.
But I was hella down with everybody, and I've always had like a very very large close circle of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm sensing that you were at other people's house already because it seems like you're foreshadowing some trouble in the family. Well, like you mentioned, you've already said like my folks were still together at that point, and I don't. Well, what were your folks moving around for? Why did you start off in Arizona and then go to California? And then go to
Boise? They were like my dad was like a free love. Fucking hippie bro, like he lived in Berkeley in 68, and that was like his thing. Like he did a lot of acid.
Nice.
And he lived on a commune basically, and he was like this hippie dude. And I think that part of him is a big part of like everything that I hope to become as a whole human, you know. And he met my mom and they fell stupid in love. And they got married within a year, and they got pregnant on their honeymoon. They took me to the place where I was conceived. It's along the banks of the Payette River outside of Boise.
Nice.
And so that, yeah. And so then they,
they're
then
like,
they,
this is the bed.
Yeah. And then they dipped to Arizona to have, to like make me happen, and then lived in Cali for a while and then moved back to Boise.
But did they have jobs?
Yeah. My mom is a graphic designer. At that point, she was a graphic designer for a major sportswear company.
Oh, cool.
At that point.
REI?
It was it's called Hind. It's a running company, and at that, in like the early, late 80s and early 90s, they were like totally killing it.
Nice.
But since then, it's become kind of a niche thing. Like, if you don't run, you probably don't know Hind, but it's a high end, it's a high end brand. And my dad at that point was, he's kind of like, after the fucking, I mean, because he was like kind of dicking around when he was probably should have been like making a career, you know, as they say. He kind of just bounced around and did a lot of things. When I was a little kid, I remember him being a bus driver for an elementary school, and I thought that was the coolest fucking job because he would take me to work sometimes when I couldn't get a babysitter. And I was like, just like right on the front of the bus with him and talk to like the lunch ladies and shit like that. Like, he was just,
that's
like,
very Bronx Tale.
Is it? I that's on my Netflix queue, but I haven't watched it.
Oh, you have not seen that?
No.
Oh, fuck. Watch it tonight, dude.
All right, cool.
Amazing movie, great soundtrack. You'll love it.
Cool. All right, I will.
Yeah.
I promise this isn't from that.
no, it's okay.
So I did that with him. He also was a janitor at Hearst Castle. I remember that. That was when we lived in the Central Coast. Hearst Castle is a fucking amazing California landmark. And I remember thinking that was like the sickest job. But he was also, he wrote children's books on the side. That was like his side hustle. And that's why his greatest ambition was to write children's books. They still collect royalties off of a couple. He was published a few times.
That's
nothing dope. Major, like no Amelia Bedelia or anything like that, but like,
he wasn't the Berenstain Bears guy?
No, but that was like his dude. Like, that was like, he was like, someday, you know? Like, that was like, yeah. That was like his shit. I had every Berenstain Bears books, and I had like five of them were autographed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and my mom was an illustrator as well as a graphic designer, so they worked together.
So dad was a dreamer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But he was like this weird, like, wandering cowboy man dreamer. Like, yeah. He was super restless, and I'm the same way. I'm like,
but like real man's man, like can fix shit and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like, and he was always so good to my mom. Like, it was, he made me really proud and like wanted to be like I've always wanted to be like my dad. And I still do, you know.
Yeah.
Like he was just like a burly, yeah, like a burly dude.
That's right.
Yeah, and my mom was she was an artist. She was a weirdo, and she's always been like, I think she probably partied really hard in the 80s. She was really into she was really into fine art and pop art and things like that, and just creating and being around creative people, dancing, probably coke, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the 80s.
She was probably a hipster. My mom was probably like, if you saw her in like
the early hipsters,
yeah, she'd probably be hanging like,
she's what the EDM chicks are trying to look like nowadays.
Yeah, or like even like, yeah, like she was definitely like she would be at like, she wouldn't look out of place at like a fucking art opening in LA right now, you know.
Tight.
Yeah.
Music was a big part of the household or no?
Never.
No.
I mean, kind of. Like, they had tapes and shit. My dad was really into, like, they had, like, four tapes that we listened to for, like, 10 years. One of them was The Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. Eagles' Greatest Hits, which is the best-selling album of all time by any artist ever. So it's not a surprise they had that. Mom was super into The Clash and, like, The Kinks and Elvis Costello. Dad liked Fleetwood Mac a lot. That was basically it, though.
I mean, those are good records to have around.
Yeah,
though.
I mean, those
are all fucking great records.
Like, you can't... You can throw a rock at a dollar bin and basically hit all of those in, like, you know, that doesn't really make sense.
Well, I mean, The Clash and Rumors and I think a few other of those are still all on my iPod too.
For sure, yeah.
So I'm down.
They're hallmarks. They're great.
Absolutely.
Great records.
But I mean, it seems like it was a creative environment.
Yeah, I think more than it was creative, it was just like, just they let me do whatever the fuck I want. Like they didn't let me do whatever the fuck I want, but anything I showed any interest in, they were like, do that. Like, go for it.
Yeah.
And that was really cool, and I think that ultimately that paid off. I mean, I don't know if it paid off, but it's like, you know, it's
currently paying off. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like I don't. I'm happy, you know.
That's good. I'm never happy, so that's good.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
No, sorry.
More Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, right? Awkward. Sorry, I made it awkward. You're in Boise, staying at the cousins, and you say your folks get their first house.
Yeah, my folks moved into this first house, and there was in this neighborhood that was hella kids that went to school with me, but some of them were bad kids.
Mm.
And one of them was a particularly bad kid, and we found out that his mom smoked weed, so we were hanging out at his house all the time, cribbing her stash, and we started smoking her weed and like stealing it, and then we were like, fuck you to her kid, because that kid was a dipshit. We just want to hang out with your mom. And then we started hanging out with this dude's mom, And she was like, no. She was like, neighborhood mom, like, buy us cigarettes, buy us whiskey. Mom, I don't know if also if my mom ever hears this. I don't know if I ever told you about this, but I'll fill you in later. Yeah. And she was like, she like taught me what a bong was. And like, we would come over.
How old was this mom?
She must have been in her early 40s.
Oh, okay.
And I was 12 and 13.
Okay. So it wasn't like the neighborhood hot mom. Like,
no, not at all. No, yeah, she was, yeah. She was hideous.
Okay.
She was hideous. I think that was like what she, maybe her ultimate ambition. I think she was just lonely, to be honest with you. And she obviously didn't see anything like, she didn't see anything like wrong with somehow like corrupting the neighborhood youth. Like, you can go to jail for that shit.
Yeah. That's some crazy shit. I mean, there's like, there's something up with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think she was definitely bipolar. But she was also probably horribly addicted to methamphetamine.
Is Boise like a meth town?
Absolutely.
Okay.
1000%. There was meth labs busted in our, I didn't live in a bad neighborhood by any means, but like there was meth labs busted within, you know, a mile of my house routinely.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing in lower middle class or lower class white neighborhoods. It's not crack. It's meth.
Yeah. I mean,
my hometown's just like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, dude, Northern California is the fucking worst. Modesto is like the fucking methamphetamine capital of the world or something.
Yeah, for sure. One year in my small hometown, it was the per capita most bus because of my town's only like 4,000 people and there's three meth lab bus.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Yeah. So anyhow, what do people do in Boise? Like, is there an industry there? Like, is it potatoes?
So it's not potatoes in Boise, but in Idaho, a lot of Idaho it is. Outside of Boise, there's a lot of agriculture. Boise, there was a big migration there when my parents moved. There was a big migration because of the tech industry was kind of on the upswing there. There's Micron, which is a boutique or by Macintosh standards, like a pretty small operation, but they were doing well. And they were PCs and they made it. It was like a Gateway. Remember Gateway?
Yeah, yeah,
it was
yeah.
Like the fucking cows and shit. Like there's a smaller manufacturer outside of or in Boise called Micron that made a lot of computers. Also HP had a factory there. There was like the outdoor industry was like booming or something. But I think that was like generally what the deal was over there in the 90s, in the early 90s.
That's what you get from the San Pellegrino, dude, is it gives you the
I
bubbles.
I know, right? Shouldn't be drinking that bougie water.
Yeah, fucking sparkling. Get that tap, cuz.
Yeah.
Did you stay in Boise all throughout high school? Is that where you graduated?
I did. I graduated from Boise High in 2003.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was awesome. And I had a fucking awesome time. And I don't regret living in Boise. I mean, I feel like people that live in major cities are afforded a lot more opportunities younger. But I also think that I think I took a lot from being around those people.
Absolutely.
And
what were you like in high school? Skater kid?
I skated a lot. Yeah, I was really down with like, it was a really cliquey school, but I was really down with basically all the cliques. Like I was really, really tight with like the soccer players. I mean, I think a lot of it was I sold weed to basically a lot of these people. And so like I kind of infiltrated in that regard. But
in small towns also, I feel like you have to kind of be a chameleon because there's not enough options to be in one clique.
Exactly. And like also I got like skateboarding was really cool until like all my friends got pregnant or like got addicted to heroin or like, you know, it was like the skate park that I grew up at a skate park. Essentially every day after school, man, I would just go to Rhodes Park. And if it wasn't for that skate park, it opened 1995. If it wasn't for that skate park, I can't honestly say that I would be in a very good position in my life. Like I don't know. Where like what I would be doing without that, and that just goes back to everything else. But like, so like the skaters started to fall off and like just like drop out. Basically, all my skater friends like just dropped out of school, and as soon as we hit high school, like a lot of them didn't make it out of junior high. And so I was kind of forced to hang out with other people. And definitely, I was just a huge pothead in high school too.
Was the entrepreneurial spirit like early on? Did you as soon as you started smoking, were you like, oh wait, I there's money in this?
No, I think it was just a matter of like. I don't know. I don't think I ever really made that much money. I never really made money.
It was just to smoke for free.
Yeah, basically. I just wanted to smoke weed for free and like hang out with my friends and just have fun. Like, I don't know. I was really compelled by psychedelics at that point too. And so, you know, I took a lot of mushrooms.
Yeah.
But outside of that, like, I never really got that into anything else. But yeah, I smoked a lot of weed in high school. That was tight. I had some girlfriends. That was tight too.
Yeah, girls are tight.
Girls are cool. Yeah,
there's nothing to do in small towns except drink and fuck.
That's the thing. Is that like I'm thinking back. I'm like, what did I do? Like, dude, I skateboarded every day. I drank a lot. I smoked a lot of weed.
Did you do good in school? You seem like a smart guy.
I actually did really not good in school.
Really?
Yeah, I did not do well in school.
Why? Rebellious youth?
I just fucking hated it. I knew it was fucking stupid. Like I knew that it was like Like, I remember, I distinctly remember having the conversation. I failed algebra twice.
No shit.
I failed algebra twice, finally made it up in summer school, failed geometry once, and then in the middle of, I was having a conversation with somebody, and they were like, you know, you don't need geometry to graduate, and the next day I dropped the class. I was like, fuck that, I'm going to ceramics. I was like, this is fucking totally bullshit. And I remember
Because at least you can make bongs and
exactly,
ceramics.
Exactly. Yeah. And I had this conversation with somebody, and I remember being like, I was talking to a teacher, and I was like, it was such a typical high schooler conversation, but I was like, why am I learning this? I'm never going to fucking need to know this. Right. And they're like, you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket. And now I want to fucking go back to high school and be like, listen, bitch, I have a calculator in my pocket all of the fucking time. I can take your picture with it and put it on Instagram too.
I got the TI-89 app.
Like, literally anything that I want to do, I have an iPhone. Like, fuck you. I wasted so much time in algebra and geometry and fuck all of that. I don't ever use it. And I mean, it's not like that shit isn't important. Like, yo, somebody has to cure cancer. Like, that, you know, it's definitely like...
You think fourth graders right now are yelling at their teachers like, why do I have to learn handwriting? Yeah. I'm just going to be typing all the time.
Absolutely. I totally think that. I know third graders who do say that.
Yeah.
Like, my Catherine's kid is like, he's a 9-year-old. I don't know, that's like third grade. And he was literally saying that shit the other day. I was like, your handwriting sucks. He's like, I'm never going to need it.
I like that you're just punking 9-year-olds. Like,
I was like, do you know cursive? And he was like, eh. And
I think they stopped teaching cursive.
Yeah.
My mom's an elementary school teacher, and I'm pretty sure that cursive has gotten taken out of the curriculum as useless now.
It's fucking useless.
Oh, dude. Terrible.
But his younger brother's 4 years old. He can pick up an iPad, slide the little thing, queue up a movie on Netflix, and watch Thomas the Tank Engine by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, go ahead and do your little cursive writing.
They're going to be into porn so soon.
I can't even believe they're not. That's something I did in Idaho. That's something I did in Boise.
Hide porn in the woods?
Oh no! I mean, I was so internet. Like, I've been internet for so long.
Had internet.
Yeah. So when I was in high school, that's when I really got into when I was skating and then smoking weed. A lot of times, like, you know, that gets old or whatever. I got into like hacking and like phone freaking and shit like that. And most kids go through that phase, I think, at least back then. And then like I got actually really into like hacking circles and shit like that. And some of my friends got too serious with it to the point where the feds came to their house and like confiscated like $10,000 in electronics bought with stolen credit cards.
Wow.
Shit like that. I was never that serious, but that got me into computers, and I kind of was just like, and that got me on the instant messenger and, you know, shit like that, chat rooms.
Cybering.
Cybering, all that shit. And that got me into Warezing, and then I found out that like with Warezing I could download like software that I can make music with. And so I started making beats when I was in like junior high, just because I was like, I don't know. I was just dicking around, you know, and that was like something I started to do. I started making beats. And then at the same time, that was just after I had been watching so many skate videos and getting really, really, really into rap. And like when my interest in rap music and marijuana dovetailed, like that's when the shit got super serious.
Yeah.
And I subscribed to The Source.
They really like go hand in hand with each other when you're youth.
Yeah. And then I subscribed to The Source. And it was game over after that. That was it.
What were the first rap tapes you were falling in love with?
Dude, I was such a white kid, like, backpack rapper. Like, okay, so one of my homies was a really, really talented skateboarder. He was the kid in our crew who, like, we always thought would go somewhere, like, with professional skateboarding. He could have if he wanted to. It wasn't his thing. But he went down to SF on a trip to go film, and he came back with this mix CD. And this mix CD had fucking...
Hieroglyphics on it.
It had hieroglyphics on it. It had fucking Grouch and Eli on it.
Yeah.
It had this group from Canada called Isosceles that I still can't find anything from, but that shit was tight.
Mm-hmm.
And it had like... It had hella Project Blown on it. It had hella ACL on it. It had hella everything. Like, it was like everything that was popping like 2001, like 2002, like California underground rap at fucking Oakland Blackouts or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. That's the same shit that opened my world at
exactly.
that time.
Yeah. It blew my mind.
Yeah,
it blew
absolutely.
My fucking mind. And I learned how to roll blunts. And then I just listened to that fucking CD over and over. And then I was like, this shit is tight. But like, then Wu-Tang was just like...
Yeah.
Like, it was just like the Triumph video. Like,
well, yeah. And that's the thing is I got it. I knew that I had a penchant more for like quote unquote underground rap before I knew what underground rap was. Cause like out of all the shit in the early 90s, it was like Wu-Tang was like, that was it. That was the alpha and omega to me. And like once I started hearing all these like underground groups that had been influenced by Wu-Tang that like weren't on majors, I was like, oh shit. Like this is what it is. I still remember my friend Adam Bue gave me a Hieroglyphics tape in like 98. And that was like what really.
Yeah.
Got me into the rabbit hole of all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually, my first rap memory was I was sitting on my couch. I was in California. I was in third grade. It was the house I told you about that my parents bought.
Yeah.
I was in third grade and I was fucking addicted to MTV. Like I would watch The Grind on like spring break. I would just stay inside and watch fucking MTV spring break and shit like that. And I just watched so much MTV. And I remember watching, MTV Jams or whatever.
And MTV Raps?
Yeah. And the What's My Name video came on, the Snoop Dogg video for What's My Name came on. One where
you don't love me, you just love my doggy style.
And he turns into the Doberman and then he bites the dad and jumps out the window.
Yeah, amazing.
It's such a fucking amazing video. And my dad fucking walked in, he was like, more like Snoop Doggy shithead. And he fucking turned off the TV and I was like, this is my shit.
Snoop Doggy shithead.
I was like, that's what I'm talking
about.
Your dad
had bars.
Yeah.
I try to like tell people like I don't know if there has been an artist with as much buzz as when Snoop was about to drop.
It was insane,
dude. Yeah, in 93 when Snoop dropped, it was like no one had ever waited for an artist to drop an album that much. Like, it's like what Drake was a couple years ago is like what Snoop was then. Maybe it's even bigger than that.
Yeah. I mean, no one fucking knew what the fuck he was. No one had any idea. Like,
yeah.
And it's crazy to see him still around. He is so bad now.
But he's a cultural icon.
Yeah. I love you, Uncle Snoop. But
yeah, shout out to Snoop. I've smoked a blunt with him.
Really?
I don't even smoke weed. And I smoke a blunt with him.
I mean, you got it when you're on.
Yeah, exactly. You have to. I have a question, though. It ties into watching MTV, because I tend to ask people that are internet or that are around my age, like, who was the first girl that you searched for on the internet? Because mine was Jenny McCarthy from Singled Out.
Really?
And it took one line at a time until her nipples popped up.
Dude, I remember that. I remember, like, oh, man, this is so personal. Yeah, I remember like, finishing before the picture was done loading, you know?
and having
a floppy disk that I hid behind the file cabinet that my parents' computer was on, you know? I didn't look for any, because my homies were super good at just getting that shit and, like, putting on floppies, and we'd trade floppies and shit. But I remember having...
How funny is it to trade porn on a floppy disk? Because that'd be the only floppy thing in the room, huh? You know what I'm saying? Come on. No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
I remember the Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee video. I remember having the link.
Yeah.
That was it. That was the first porn I remember watching.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's an iconic porn.
You smoke weed with Snoop Dogg. I gave dabs to Tommy Lee the other day. And all I could think of was like, I seen you fuck Pamela Anderson.
Bang.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, whatever it takes, that's some very L.A. shit.
Yeah.
That's a very L.A. shit to shake hands with Tommy Lee.
Yeah.
When does the rebellious youth start for you as far as not paying attention in school? That's high school, early high school?
Was there trouble
in the household?
Yeah, well, I feel like that didn't even have anything to do with it. I don't know. Like, so my parents split when I was 15. My dad was working a night job, and my mom realized that she didn't miss him when he wasn't sleeping next to her.
Mm.
And so they started talking about it, and then they took me to ice cream and told me they were getting a divorce, and I fucking lost my shit, as anybody would. I feel like 15's late, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like I got a pretty good run out of it. But my pops was like I was saying earlier, is that like he's a Rolling Stone, bro. Like he was always on the move, and I feel like at that point he thought that I was set. Like, he was like, well, I taught him how to shave. He knows, you know, my table manners are fucking impeccable.
You already have your learner's permit.
Right. And so he was like, you know, I'm going to do my own thing. And he did. And so he left and I'm stuck with mom. He was staying in town, but it wasn't like he was around, and he got back into drinking, and like, he was just kind of like trying to be my bro, like kind of like
he,
dad
he was
bro.
Trying to be the neighborhood dad.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the neighborhood mom.
Exactly. And like, but I mean, yeah, he never is malicious, but like, I remember like, yeah, like I'd go over there and there wouldn't be shit in the fridge except for like Hungry Man's and like a six pack, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, cool, you know, do your thing, dad. Like, whatever. Mom's got me. it's all good. And then he dipped and then he left. He went to Arizona. He moved to Arizona when I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
He went to go live with his mom.
To live with his mom?
Yeah.
Why, was she having health issues or just like...
She was. She was having health issues and she died shortly after. She died like 2004.
Bummer.
2004, yeah. She had a good run too, though.
That's good. That's all you can ask for. Both of my grandparents, both my grandfathers died while they were in their 50s. So,
damn.
Yeah,
dude.
How about that? I feel like I'm on a ticking clock right now, you know?
It's rough, dude.
Yeah.
It's hereditary. We're only getting, our life expectancy is increasing exponentially. I mean, they fucking...
We'll see. I've been using this body pretty hard.
Yeah, same.
So.
But you know what I'm saying? Let's go back to YOLO.
Yeah, exactly. We're out here YOLOing. So, did you go to college?
So when I was a senior in high school, I was going to graduate. My mom was like, just fucking graduate. Like, do it. Like, I don't fucking care what you do. Just graduate high school. You're not going to live here after your senior year of high school, so you got to figure that out. And just fucking graduate, and we'll figure something out. And at this point, her She had a business. She moved when she moved to Boise. She started her own business with the two partners. Eventually, they both split. Mom was running it out of the kitchen or out of the guest bedroom, and she was like, you know, she had her office, but then she moved into the house. At that point, I didn't really realize, but I think things were probably not doing so hot at the office. Mm-hmm. You know, her number one priority was to like just fucking get me out of the fucking house,
because she's out here trying to YOLO too.
Exactly, dude. And she'd been married since she was 21. Mm-hmm. So she was definitely trying to YOLO, and then. So I had the source. I told you I subscribed to the source. Mom thought that I was only into black chicks because I would cover my wall. The only magazine I had around was Thrasher source. And the source. Yeah. So I'd put up like some fine ass women, but they're all
it's all Trina and Little Kim
it was
on your wall.
Literally Trina riding a fucking like inflatable dolphin right next to my bed. And I was like, Diamond Princess, like that was my first love. And then so mom was like. Yeah, mom, killing it. And then so in the back of the source there was an ad for this school called Full Sail, which is
that's the one that they advertise on TV where it's like, hey, you're sitting on the couch right now, why are you sitting on the couch, get up and make a phone call.
You could be Timbaland. And I was like, yeah, tight. I was like, this, I was making beats on my computer. All my friends were like, yeah, this shit's tight. Like, it's a bunch of fucking white stone kids in fucking Boise, Idaho. Yeah. Getting a little liquid courage. And I went to Florida for 1 year thinking that I was going to be like make some beats and be basically Scott Storch, like, you know. And then that was 2003, and I moved out to Florida. I moved to Orlando for 1 year, and I went to school for like 50 hours a week. It's like you do a 2 year program in 1 year, and I fucking hated it, and it was fucking awful. I smoked.
Orlando's kind of butt, dude.
Okay, Central Florida's real, real booty. It's real bad, and it wasn't it was also like weirdly crime ridden. Like,
yeah,
it's not like Disneyland is. There's like a fucking fence around Disneyland, and the rest is just.
I was in Orlando last year for the first time, and I just to fly into the airport because we were heading to Daytona, mm-hmm. And it was so surprising driving from the airport to Daytona. Like, it was literally like the sticks.
Yeah,
like it was shitty. A fucking hick town. Yeah. Dude. You know, no shots fired at fucking Florida.
We fuck with you, Florida.
Yeah, I fucks with you. But, like, I was really surprised. I was like, this looks like my hometown. I'm like, this is weird.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have expected it.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. It was really weird. And Orlando was just bad. And, no, sorry, Orlando. I don't but also, I didn't, like, have a great experience there. You know, I was going to school a lot. I hated my roommate.
Did you have a car?
I didn't have a car.
Yeah, that's a bummer when you're in a new place without a car.
Exactly. We got hit by Hurricane Gene. There was a four-day blackout.
Fuck you, Gene.
Yeah. It was bad. Actually, my mom, so weirdly, my mom for that Christmas had given me a phone card, and my dad had given me a headlamp for Christmas. And then in February, I think it was, Gene hit, and I was the only motherfucker on the block, like on the only fucking motherfucker in my entire apartment complex that could make a phone call.
Lights and a phone. Yeah,
and I had a fucking headlamp.
Damn, survival kit.
Yeah, it was tight. The blackout, that shit will make you really realize, like, that you see the depths of human depravity when you don't have gas or air conditioning in Florida.
Could you flush toilets and stuff?
There was tap water, but it was contaminated, so you had to boil it.
Holy shit.
It was bad. It was really, really bad. There was looting. There was lots of looting. People getting stabbed in line at the gas station and shit like that.
Damn.
Yeah.
That sounds crazy.
It was really gnarly.
Man, Florida, clean your shit up, dog.
Yeah.
Chill out, Florida.
Yeah, so I got the fuck out of there.
Yeah, so you lasted a year there. I mean, how did you like Full Sail?
Full Sail was a complete joke. It was a fucking nightmare. Everybody there had basically been duped into it the same way I had.
Yeah.
And I made the most of it. I actually got really good grades that 1 year I went to college.
Was it accredited? Like, could you actually get a bachelor's there?
I have an associate's. I got an associate's degree.
Oh, shout.
Yeah. That's where I got the vocabulary, too. Yeah. No, I got an associate's degree, and I really learned a lot about electronic music, actually, in Florida. Florida breaks were a huge thing at the time, and my roommate introduced me to drum and bass. He was from Sacramento, actually, and I was like, "This, what the fuck is this stupid techno you listen to?" And he's like, "Nah, it's like rap, only twice as fast." And I was like, "Oh!" And then I heard that, I was like, "How do you mix it?" And I like jimmied his lock when he would leave town. He would go home for the holidays, and I couldn't go back, so I would jimmy his lock on his room, and I just taught myself how to, like, it was the first time I learned to mix vinyl. Was on my roommate's, he was a hip hop, he was like a rap head too, Filipino cat, so you know he could scratch.
Yeah, amen.
Shout.
He's Korean, don't worry about it. So he could break dance.
Yeah, yeah.
Shout outs to Database.
so he was hella good at scratching and DJing, and he wanted to like teach me until I was a fucking horrible roommate, and then we hated each other, and then I could only use his turntables when he wasn't there. So that was tight. That was cool. I learned a lot about music when I was out there, but none of it from Full Sail. I also saw Cocaine for the first time out there, but didn't do it. I did do a lot of mushrooms while I was there.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't do coke till you met Tommy Lee, obviously.
Obviously, yeah.
Last night.
Yeah. and then, yeah, so then I dipped and I moved back to...
Boise?
I moved back to Boise.
Did mom let you move back in?
No, I stayed with my dad, and he. It was a really weird time in his life. He was staying in a one bedroom apartment. I had an ASR-10 that I bought when I lived in Florida, and hella wax. I had hella vinyl when I was out there because I had nothing else to do but dig for wax and skateboard and go to school because I didn't have any friends. So I made a lot of beats out there. I had really kind of like stepped into the beat shit and like started taking it seriously. And I had an ASR-10, and then when I moved back to Boise, I only took my records and my sampler, and I set up shop in my dad's fucking one bedroom apartment. And well, it was a two-bedroom apartment. It was a small two-bedroom. And I set up shop up there at the foot of my bed was a sampler. And I just make beats and, like, wait for my friends.
Did you have a nom de plume?
Dude, I had so many.
Yeah.
I was making beats as, like, the stereotype.
Hell yeah.
It was such a...
Shout-outs to DJ Stereotype. What's up?
Yeah, the most backpacker fucking name.
dude, one of my friends' names is DJ Stereotype.
Really?
You know him. You probably know him.
Really?
Yeah, he's, like, part of Ham on Everything.
Oh, no. Mine was The Stereotype.
The Stereotype. Okay.
And then, like, I fucking had, like, The Art of Fact. They were all, like...
The Art of Fact.
You know what I'm saying, though?
That's like, amazing.
You know what I'm saying? Like...
Oh, I mean, now, I'm still stuck with a backpacker-ass rap name. Like, I fucking hate my rap name, but I'm not gonna change it because I feel like that's a desperate last-ditch effort. You know, Intuition is a very backpackery name, and that comes from a backpackery time. So, I'm owning it.
Yeah, I mean, and as well you should.
I know fucking Johnny Come Lately.
What's that?
I said, I'm no Johnny
exactly,
Come Lately.
Exactly.
You know what I'm
saying? You're OG backpacker.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's... And fucking shouts to you because
that's the art of fact, you know?
Yeah, well, you kept doing it, and I was just like, ugh.
Yeah, but the difference between us is I kept doing it, but you are now making money off of it, which is smarter. So how did you end up leaving Boise, or, like, what was the inspiration to, like...
So Dad was, like, as you can imagine, it was a super bummer scenario. He was drinking a lot and, like, just not being a productive human. And
broing out? Like, was he...
He was just chilling, watching golf and drinking, like, Johnny Walker and 7-Up, like, this weird pink 7-Up they had for a bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was his shit. And then... So he was like, you got to do something. And I was like, okay.
Were you helping pay rent or anything?
No.
You didn't have any menial jobs or nothing?
No, it was a very temporary thing. Mm-hmm. It was just a landing pad while I figured out the next step. And then I was there for probably 3 months. And he was like, you got to fucking figure something out. So I was looking up. He's like, where have you never been? And I was like, I've never been to San Francisco. And he was like, do you know anybody in San Francisco? And I was like, I know absolutely no one in San Francisco. And he's like, you should probably go there. And I was like,
what drew you to San Francisco in your head? Like, what?
Skateboarding. And like, then I was like, and then I realized Quantum Projects, which is Blackalicious's label. Alphabetic Aerobics was like the anthem when I was in high school or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like, I was a huge Blackalicious fan, Shadow, Lyterix, all that. And, I hit them up and they're like, if you come, we'll interview you for an internship. No guarantees.
No shit.
Yeah. And so I went down there and in the interview for that internship, they were just like,
they're like, so did you go to Full Sail? Do you make beats?
Exactly. They're just like, why
do you have
an
associate's degree in beats?
They're like, why are you here? And I was like, oh, I moved to San Francisco to intern for you. And they're like, oh, well, I guess we have to give it to you now. And I was like, yeah.
They're like, well, we can't be assholes.
Yeah. And so I got off the train. I got off BART. And I had a backpack and a skateboard. And I walked 3 blocks to the hostel where I was staying. And I was there for 3 weeks. And I couldn't find a job. And I was hating it. I had... Dad had bought me a one-way ticket, and I had I had some graduation money. I had like $2,000 in graduation money, and I blew through that super fucking fast. And I was like on my last $100, and I got a job at the Starbucks across the street from the hostel I was staying at, and that gave me incentive to like stay there and finish the internship. And I did the internship for about a year, maybe less.
So you stayed
at
a hostel for the whole year?
No, I stayed at a hostel for 3 weeks, and then I got a fucking closet. I got a closet in a house full of 22 Chinese people in the Inner Sunset. I was the only English-speaking person. The room was $325 a month. It had one window. It wouldn't fit a twin bed. So they had like this fucking like... It was
a
like
hammock?
It was basically like a fucking wooden table with a fucking foam mat on it. And then a tiny little TV in the corner. And then I opened the door and I was like out. And like this...
You were getting laid constantly in San Francisco.
Basically.
how do you even find a place like that?
Craigslist.
Wow.
And it was like,
how many people did you share a bathroom with?
I was fortunate because that little room was in the main apartment, which was this dude Peter Chen and his wife. Peter spoke almost no English. His wife spoke absolutely no English.
But shout outs to Peter Chen.
Fucking that dude saved me. So dude, that guy is like top five Dead or Alive.
Like, see, that guy, without Peter Chen, you guys wouldn't know who Skrillex is.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
But he, yeah, Peter Chen, he was the homie. He hooked it up. And he, I shared a bathroom with him. He was like 65, 70, and his 78-year-old wife or whatever. And that was disgusting. And
22 people, that's all. But seems
then,
so crazy.
And then there was, yeah, there's four stories. It was basically like a flop house for Chinese students because it was right by the university. So I never ever met like anybody else in the house. I would just come and do my thing.
Wow.
But she was such a sweet lady. She would bring me Chinese food that she cooked all the time. But if you've ever eaten authentic Chinese food, you know it's fucking disgusting. So she would like bring me this little bowl.
You are
like,
offending so many people.
I'm sorry,
isn't it?
I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. Fucking wait, we've got Florida Chinese people.
Chicago.
Like, wow.
Yeah. My mom. My own mother. And like she'd bring me this food and she'd like sit there to watch me eat it. And I'd be like, this is so good.
You gotta choke it down.
And then I'd fucking like have to take a couple bites and be like, I'm going.
But would she bring you a fork or chopsticks?
She'd bring me a fork.
That's so funny.
From there, I found another spot. I moved in with a dude from Starbucks. I moved in his apartment, like subletted for the summer. I met a very, very, very close homie of mine at that Starbucks who worked at a record store around the corner. He would just come in and get coffee every day. And I was like, you look like you like rap music. He's like, come see me at the record store. And, he's my very good friend, Lauren. I love that dude. He's like a very, very close friend of mine to this day. And, he got me a job at the record store. And so I quit Starbucks. I actually spilled scalding hot coffee on a Swedish toddler and fucking started screaming at their parents. And then I literally pulled a Scarface like from
you're like, fuck you, I'm out.
I was literally like, fuck all of you, I'm out of here.
Wow.
And I took off my apron and walked out. And then I got a job at the record store the next day.
That's crazy. But you were still interning the whole time?
I was interning until like 3 weeks into the record store job. And then they were like, you know what? You've done plenty.
What did you learn while you were interning?
Nothing. I mean, I learned how to package this record promos. I learned that you used to ship vinyl. You used to send vinyl promos to DJs, which is crazy. I still talk to a dude that I intern for all the time. He's like really, they're both like really high up at Apple, I think now, and
no
iTunes.
Shit. No shit.
Which is great for them. I didn't learn much though, but they hooked me up with a studio in Oakland, where that like I could, if I brought in my own clients, I could charge them $10 an hour and use the equipment. That's when I learned that I never, ever, ever want to work in a recording studio. And that's when like the whole shit changed. I was like, I'm never going
to
be.
Cause that was the initial dream.
Yeah. I wanted to be an engineer and like a producer and all this shit. And I was like, never, ever. I never wanted to do that again. But I was working at the record store and that was cool. And then from there, I met another cat through him, who got me a job as a bathroom attendant
at the club.
It was a really, really nice restaurant that had like a clubby vibe. And from there I started, I liked it. I took to it really well and they loved me. And I'm
to being a bathroom attendant, like the dude who like gives you the towels. Do you want to buy a cigarette for a quarter?
Yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Thing?
As that dude.
Did you used to give out like sagely advice? I feel like sometimes those guys are very wise. Like
I try to tell people not to fuck in the stalls, but they just did it anyway.
Get out.
So it was like that kind of place.
That's crazy.
It was pretty bad. But I went from that. Like I did that. Then I went to busboy. Then I went to food runner. I went to barback, bartender, a server.
All at the same place?
Yeah.
So you just worked your way up the chain?
Yeah, in 4 years.
And now you're the head chef.
Exactly.
No, I'm just kidding.
I wish. It closed down, actually. I left when they closed. I met my first love there, though. I met the woman who totally changed my whole shit at that time and made me want to be like
a better person.
Yeah, man. Like I talk to her today. I talk to her every day. She's like one of my best friends still.
Women can do that.
Yeah, she's incredible. And she was like a super, super talented young chef, and she moved on. We moved in together ultimately, and we had a dog and a cat, and her career fucking took off.
And like, she's actually in the other room. Come on out.
I'm kidding. She's an editor at Bon Appetit now.
Oh, it's sick.
Yeah. She's killing
she's
it.
She's doing good.
Yeah. She's killing
it. You guys were like a young power couple. You just didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the idea.
Mm.
But I was, you know, I was very, very into my ways of being,
Did you guys start living together?
Yeah. We started living together and she taught me how to cook, and I'll never be able to thank her enough for that. The whole shit, like the whole restaurant thing and being with her, and like she just turned me onto a whole world that I didn't understand. That was like when the Food Network was cracking, and like that, just being there for that in San Francisco at that time, like 2005, it was just,
that's a culinary mecca.
Yeah, it blew my mind, and I got really into it, and I was making fucking tons of money. Like it was like the money that you made waiting tables in San Francisco, the money you can make is insane, because they're forced to pay minimum wage, which is $10 an hour. You walk out with $400 in tips. It's like
you're doing good.
You're doing a lot better than people with college degrees in a lot of cases.
I was living in Santa Barbara for quite a while, and up there, that's pretty much all there is a service industry. So a lot of people that were born and raised there, they end up being waiters at like really nice restaurants. And like my friends that are waiters are fucking caked up, dude. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was a great time. I had a fucking blast. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And then after that, like We just broke up because I was young. We were really young. We were too young.
Yeah.
And she moved.
I feel like you always meet the best one too early on or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and
like, then you spend the rest of your life trying to chase that same one, or like, but like a different version of her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's funny because I don't even know what my type is at this point. But it's sorry, it's not her. but she's like one of my best friends. Like to this day, I talk to her every day. Like she's literally one of my closest friends, and one of the people that's dearest to me. I think she would say the same thing about me, though, for sure.
When the restaurant closes, is that like the end of your San Francisco tenure?
No. So what happened when then? Like that kind of happened around the same time that we broke up, and I moved into a skate house. Right as they opened Potrero del Sol Skate Park, which is one of the best skate parks on the West Coast, I think. It's fucking awesome. It's an awesome park, and it's in the Mission. I lived in the Mission. The energy there was so fun, as like just being skating, waiting tables, all the food, like all the restaurants started opening up down there. It's like first wave of heavy gentrification, and I was like riding it in a very real way, and I felt great about it. and it was dope. And I lived in a house with 9 skaters, and we built a ramp, and we had fucking barbecues, and we drank a lot of beer. And I was DJing at the time. At that point, I had gotten really into DJing and promoting. I was throwing parties in SF.
What were you DJing?
I started doing club stuff, like more club music. And I had met a friend named Carlo in the process of the whole thing. And he is another one of my very, very close friends. And I really, really wouldn't be doing what I'm doing without this dude. And he turned me on to electronic music, like full on, and taught me how to beat match, taught me how to mix like 16 bar intros, taught me how to rock clubs, and taught me how to like just basically how to throw parties and do that kind of thing. And it was through him.
Were you guys throwing like warehouse parties? Were you throwing like house parties?
We were doing club nights.
Club nights.
Yeah, we had this party called Damn Gina that was at a super, super nice club.
Shout out to Martin.
Yeah, dude. It was at a super nice club called The Ambassador that couldn't do anything on the weekdays. Like there was just, their audience was just not there for the weekdays and they needed to fill it. So we were like, give us $2 drink night and let us tear it up. And we did. Like we got, we eventually got asked to leave. Like we blew it the fuck up. There was like a 2-hour wait every Tuesday for a while. It was sick, man. It was cool. It was a really, really gnarly fun club night. Damn Gina, $2 drinks. Shout out. Just stopped. It just.
What years was this?
This was like 2007 or 2008 until 2010.
Do you think you moved into the dance world more because like the backpacker movement was kind of over at that point? Like there wasn't a big hip hop scene going on, like other than the hyphy movement in San Francisco.
Not at the time. Yeah. A lot of it was shutting down. Yeah. I feel like the backpacker shit, like, I don't know. It was like, it wasn't a thing, but Mac Dre had just been murdered, and it was like, it was seriously like going, it was the whole city was going so crazy still. There was some seriously like, the energy in Oakland especially was pretty palpable. And I had gotten into, through skateboarding and through skateboarding and like, and this other job that I was working for a sec, I met people who were connected with Thrasher Magazine. And, I think that I started writing for them at a certain point. And a lot of the stuff that I was covering was like Def Jux and things like that. Like, it was like the post Def Jux, like win, like big era. But it was like, and like Atmosphere. I'd always been super into Atmosphere, but like, there's still shit coming out. That's like, and it wasn't exactly happening in California, but there's so much shit like that was happening elsewhere that I could kind of tap into that. And like, it was still intriguing to me. But at that time, I'd also really gotten familiar with like the hypey shit, and I was a huge student of Mac Dre.
You were just out there trying to function.
I was out there trying to function, and I became like historically very familiar with the entire like just Bay movement and the bubble. And it really is a bubble. And anybody who says it's not is like, when you live there, there's people that are rich off the Bay that don't leave and that you've never heard of, like, and you know, that's now coming to light with his records being like totally like. Like the expose, you know, and then turn it like all that shit. But it's still like it's still one of the most intriguing rap scenes in the world, in the country at least. And they produce some of the most unique artists. So that was always like really compelling to me. And at the time I was writing for Thrasher, and I kind of saw it as an opportunity to like just kind of dig in further with rap music. And then the electronic stuff was just paying my bills. Like really, I didn't really listen to it as much, but at a certain point I started to, and to be dead honest with you, I took ecstasy for the first time.
I got it.
I understood. And I tried to make out with a lesbian, and then her girlfriend like got super bummed out on me. And then like I left the rave, but that was like, it really was that.
I've always kind of said, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I always say like all the smart backpacker DJs got into dance music at the right time.
And it's weird because, yeah, you're totally right. And all of that rap shit was going on at, like at raves. Mm-hmm. Like the Far Side used to perform at raves. Like mm-hmm. J5 used to perform at raves. Hyro, all that shit. Like there was always a rap room, mm-hmm. from what I understand. I wasn't even there, but like mm-hmm. this is what people had told me. And so like was that I mean, that's where you saw like it was cool. It's cool. I don't think a lot of people understand how tight, like how closely affiliated like Ecstasy was to rap music in the Bay for so long before it's like now it's a national thing. Obviously, it's like in every rap song. But like,
mm-hmm. I mean, Rick Ross is out here putting it in bitches' drinks.
Yeah, you know exactly.
Oh, shady ass Rick Ross.
You should know better.
Yeah.
It's, but yeah, I mean, that's been a thing in the Bay for a long time.
Throwing the Damn Gina party, is this kind of where you got your first idea of like, oh, wait, I'm good at promoting things. I'm good at putting people onto shit.
It was more like, it was like through that kind of thing, I just kind of realized I was good at being friends with people and then like good at meeting people. And I don't even think I ever thought of it that way, but it was like a thing where I was like, I just had a lot of friends and I liked having them all in the same room at one time. And that became very profitable. At the same time, it became, you know, I hate using the word, but like interpersonal skills are like something that like you can't really teach somebody, I feel like. And it's something that's always come naturally to me and something that
as Gladwell would say, you're a connector and a maven. You know what I mean?
Who's that?
You don't know Malcolm Gladwell?
Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, you would love him.
Is the tipping point?
Yeah, Tipping Point, yeah, Outliers, et cetera, et cetera. The Tipping Point is all about like types of people and the connectors and mavens. You know, that's like why we know who Paul Revere is, but not the other guy who was on the same road that night, because Paul Revere was a connector, you know? Like he had friends. He was good at interpersonal relationships, the same thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, I never really thought of that as like an opportunity, as like something that I could monetize. But it's something that became clear to me that I was good at and I was strong. It was a strong suit.
Yeah. So what happens after that? Where do you...
So basically I was waiting tables. I was making a lot of money at doing it. I was throwing this party. I was living in a skate flop house, which is great. Things kind of like in my personal life kind of came to like a really weird... like my ex, who my first love, the girl that I had moved in with and then just broken up with and had... on so many other levels become such a huge part of my life. Even though we weren't together at that point, she decided that she was moving to New York. And I got a call from my mother, and I was in the middle of a shift waiting tables. So I guess it was in January, we threw this huge party. We threw the biggest, most successful event we had thrown at that point. And I made enough money, and I made a good deal of money from it. And I was like, I need to spend this on making more money somehow. Like I need to like... I didn't want to blow it, you know? I didn't want to party it away. And that was one of the best adult decisions I ever made. I probably should have gone to the dentist or something. But instead, I was like, I'm going to go to South by Southwest and figure this out and see what happens. Just go figure it out. And I was going to go as a journalist and, like, you know, cover South by.
For Thrasher.
But that didn't really pan out.
This is when you're – this is, like, what, 2008?
This is, like, 2010 in January. In mm-hmm. January 2010. And in February, Allison had decided, my ex, who's at that point still very much a part of my life – she had it was right around my birthday. It was in the middle of February. She moved to New York, and it didn't take it well. It was really hard for me, and it was kind of like what ultimately set into a lot of change. Like it set into, it was like one of the first things that really started like kind of shake up my life at that point. And I was waiting tables a couple days later, and I got a call from my mother, telling me that my dad committed suicide.
Oh my God.
And
I had no idea that this was going there.
Yeah, my pops killed himself.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
In 2010. No, it's okay.
Oh shit.
And my dad took himself out, and I lost my shit. Like my fucking world collapsed. Like I love my dad. Like at that point, he was like all that. Like he was like, I felt like even though he hadn't really been there and like hadn't done like a lot for me in like the last like 7 years or something, like I knew that he was really proud of me, and I knew that he had taught me a lot of good things about being a man and being an adult and being a good just a good person, like just a genuinely like whole individual, like spiritually.
While you were in San Francisco, had you guys been in close contact with each other?
Like, we talked, but I hadn't seen him for a long time.
I mean, did you have any? Was it just out of the fucking blue, or what? Like,
we had talked, but it was like it was kind of like he had these health issues, he had heart problems, he had lost his job, he lost his driver's license, primarily all due to drinking, and he was just in a really bad spot. And it became very evident. I forgot to tell you, there was a point earlier in my elementary school where my parents were in a New Age cult. But he, wow. He had lost a great deal of like purpose. He had really no purpose. I had kind of taken off and like been doing my own thing. Mom's wasn't really talking to him anymore. and he didn't have anything in his life, and he never really wanted to be around anyway. Mm-hmm. I kind of felt like I never felt like he was like a man of this time, if that makes sense. And so he left, and I never felt like I don't felt like he left me. I don't think I don't I think that he had done everything that he possibly could have for me at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved him, and he knew that, and that was the last thing I ever said to him. And when he left, it was just like I had to do something, you know.
Fuck. So you fly home.
Flew home and saw mom, and we dealt with it, and his brother was there or whatever, but he never talked to his brother anymore. And it was like I was going back to Boise, and I saw my mom there, and I was just like, I don't want to do this. Like, I can't be this. I can't have this, like, as a part of my life. Like, I was just like, I have to fucking do something. I kind of felt like I was in a dead end in San Francisco, and I went to South By. I had already bought my ticket, and all that happened, and I went back to Boise. And I told, when I was in Boise, I told everybody that I was going to get a job at South By. So I was like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to, you know, go down there and like network and use all these interpersonal skills that I supposedly had, had figured out. And, I went down there, and in the meantime, when I was writing for Thrasher, I had become acquainted with this woman, Catherine, because she was sending me press releases and things like that. And I had talked to her prior because I kind of always figured that the person sending me press releases probably made more money than me about for like writing, because Thrasher paid like $150 an article.
Yeah.
You know, that shit took so much time. So it's like, I was kind of like thought of that as like maybe publicity as like a viable alternative to journalism and maybe something I could do long term. And she, I had read an article about her that said she was waiting tables when she built the company and like all this, she's like really hustled, and she's a woman in the music industry, which is one, a very, very difficult thing to accomplish. And she's wildly successful even at this point. So I covered a lot of her artists.
The way you guys send emails, it kind of makes you want to respond back and start a conversation with you guys.
That's the idea.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's very like, oh, wait, they wrote this to me. Yeah. Even though I know it's probably going to 100 other people, it's like, oh, this feels like it's to me.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah.
But at that point, I didn't know shit about it. Like, I was just like, oh, this would be, yeah, write a press release. I could do that.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, so I'll go down there. I'll go to South by Southwest and I'll find her. I was like, how hard could that be? So I followed her, basically her second hand, her like right hand, this woman, Dana, on Twitter. This other dude, Trevor, I followed him on Twitter, followed him on Facebook. I was like, I'm going to find him, you know, I'm going to track him down. I went to the showcase, didn't see him, didn't get in because like I didn't have a fucking pass. I'm staying at a hostel on like the other side of the fucking river. It was like totally poorly planned. And then I was like looking for them the whole time. I couldn't find them. I had a blast. I wrote some shit for a blog. It was cool. But I left really kind of upset and like a little disappointed in myself that I hadn't made anything happen. I didn't really connect with anybody I thought that was going to ultimately behoove my professional career. And I was in the airport, in the Austin airport on Saturday. I left a day early, and I looked up in the security line, and I saw Dana, who was her right hand. And I was like,
fate.
I was like, all right, hey, hi, Dana. I'm Clayton. I write for Thrasher. Sometimes we talk on email. And she's like, hey, this is Catherine. Catherine was like, hi, let me buy you lunch. And I sat down with her at lunch, and I was kind of just thinking about it. I was like, I'm trying to like impress her or whatever. But then at the end of it, I was like, I'll do anything to work for you. Like, I'll basically throw my life away to come to Chicago and like, and learn from you and like do what you do. And like, I just need a change, and it's time for me. And I hope that that's something that resonates with you. And she was like, I'm sure she was like, what a fucking weirdo. Okay. But then 3 weeks later, I got a call, or like a week later, I got a call from her, and she was like, if you move here in 3 weeks, she's like, I'm firing somebody. If you can be here in 3 weeks, you can live in my house and you can intern.
Wow.
And we'll see what happens. And I got rid of all my shit. I sold all of my, I just left an entire furnished house basically
in San Francisco.
Yeah. In SF, and just dipped and like did it. And I moved out there, and I lived there for a year, and it was, I lived in the house when I first got there, and I was like so jazzed, and I was like, oh, Chicago's gonna be great. And I immediately hated it.
Right.
And I didn't like it at all. I didn't know anybody, and the work was really, really hard. And she's not an easy woman to work for at first. Like, it was like, she's a very distinct style of like living.
Right.
You know, she's not like, she doesn't take it easy on people.
But you're living for free in the house, and the payment is like you intern for her.
Yeah. And I had $2,000 that's all my dad left me. And I lived on that in Chicago for a couple months while I lived with her, and it didn't really work out at Biz3. Like, it didn't
really,
it was really, really
at first.
Yeah, man. It was like, it just didn't happen how I thought it was going to happen. I thought I'd hit the ground running, but it was like a really long learning process that took about a year and a half. And I went through some serious, like I've never been more depressed about anything in my life. Like, losing my pops was one thing. I've lost a lot of people. I've dealt with suicide in a number of contexts, and just death in general and dealing with shitty life shit. But I've never been fucking more depressed than I was when I didn't think that I could do that job. When I thought I had failed myself, and I really,
what was it about it that wasn't clicking?
It was just an organization. It was just having a desk job, bro. Like things you learn in college that like I just had never done. Like
right. Keeping lists, fucking keeping calendars, organization. That's a hard thing to get used to when you do it all in your head for your whole life.
It was using my brain in a way that I didn't know that people use their brains to put it best. Like it's like, and it was just, I just was a kid, you know, I was a kid and I was in San Francisco, and I think that I love you, San Francisco, but I think it's a really great place to kind of live in an infinite, adolescence. And I definitely was doing that. Like, and it was, I had no responsibilities and it was incredible. And I'm so glad that I did that. I'm so glad that I didn't like, I've always been a super ambitious person. I've never been one to rest on my laurels. It was just that, like, I think my ambition was misplaced, not even misplaced, but placed elsewhere in terms of when I was in San Francisco, like I really wanted to learn to scratch and I taught myself to scratch. I really wanted to learn to be a good DJ. I learned how to mix records. I wanted to throw a good party. I did that. I really wanted to make wait tables and learn a lot about food. And I did that. But at a certain point I was just like, I need to get my shit right. And like, none of this is paying my bills.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, none of it's like going to ultimately buy my mom a house.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to go work for Catherine and when I went to Biz 3, it was like, oh, that's like, that was some serious shit. Like, not only did I have to do a grown up job, I had to like fucking go to the dentist. Like I had to fucking go to the doctor, you know, I had to like pay taxes. And that was all shit that I learned there too. And I think it was just kind of like a landslide of responsibility that I didn't know that I thought I was ready for, but I really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was really formative. It was like, I've never been so depressed in my entire life. I went 48 hours, I went like 3 days without sleep. I just paced my house.
Mm-hmm.
I had a horrible anxiety attack for like 3 days and I became so, it's so fucking cliched. I became suicidal. It was like, I just had this horrible fucking like I snapped basically. Mm-hmm. I like fucking snapped. It mm-hmm. was really, really rough.
And this was at Catherine's house?
This was just after I had moved out. And I really thought that I was like I had been doing it in Catherine. It was like good. It was going well enough. And I thought that I was learning and I was like, I invested into Chicago finally. I was like, I'm not going to do this unless I'm going to fucking do this, you know? And, so I did, and I made friends, and I developed a really close circle of friends, of good friends, but it didn't stop me from the fact that like I felt like I wasn't going to like build anything of note at that point. Like I felt like I was going to lose my job at any minute, and ultimately they turned that around, and I worked 12-hour days, and I if I wasn't going to be the one that did it the best, I was definitely going to be the one that wanted it the most. And I have so many fucking personal shortcomings then and now and forever. But the one thing that I fucking will put up, I'll fucking put it up against anybody. Like when I'm going to fucking do something, I fucking...
Persistence.
I'm going to fucking do it. Like or die trying. And I basically almost died trying. Yeah. But I fucking did that and it was great. And it became one of the most fruitful relationships of my entire life. My relationship with Catherine has been incredible. She's a mother to me. She's a confidant. She's one of my best friends.
It's scary when a mentor figure comes into your life and you realize how kind of much you've been not reaching your potential before. You know what I mean? Like learning about all the shortcomings that you have from a mentor figure can really shake up your life. Like that happened to me a couple years ago. And like, I didn't realize what a fuck up I was before that and like how shitty I was really living my life before that. It is very emotionally jarring. And a mentor oftentimes, it can be a love-hate relationship. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was like, do you really want people in your life that are just going to coalesce and be like, yo, you're doing great.
Yeah, you're cool.
Yeah, fuck yeah. Like, awesome, good job. Like, no, I don't fucking...
You need somebody that has the balls to tell you that you're being a piece of shit.
Yeah, exactly. And Catherine was that person.
Yeah.
And she I was. She couldn't have been more right. I was like looking back on my life and like the way I was living in SF, it wasn't like, you know, I was a reprehensible character, you know, mm-hmm. I was drinking tall cans in the middle of the street every day.
Mm-hmm.
So
was there a moment where, you felt like, oh, this is starting to click?
Yeah, it was like, it was when it wasn't validation from her, necessarily as much as it was from other people. Like, and one of those people was Sunny. One of those people was Skrillex. It was like,
how did you guys meet?
Basically Catherine, is very good friends with Craig Kalman, who's a, who's an executive at Atlantic. He's a boss. He's like a fucking like G. Like yeah. He's like a the record executive dude. Like he's an OG. He's a really fucking awesome.
Yeah,
guy.
That's my uncle. I know. No, I'm just kidding.
And he had been friends with Catherine for years, and he approached Catherine because there was basically Skrillex had become this thing that they had signed, and they didn't really like it was. He was exploding. Like he was like exploding.
And they didn't like understand or know what to do with it.
Yeah, basically like it was a major label and it happened so fast that no one really understood it or knew what was happening. And the general public definitely didn't know about it. But the kids were fucking going crazy for this kid and they had to capitalize on it. And so he called Catherine, who's a publicist who's been doing this for, you know, years and years and years. And I remember she stood up in the office and she was like, her way is to like break you in by like throwing you in some shit. And like
trial by fire.
Yeah. And she stood up in the middle of the office one day and she's like, who here knows what dubstep is? And I had been DJing for the last 4 years. And like, I was like, you know, I knew, but I didn't know. No. And I was like, I guess I know. And I was like, cool. She's like, you're on Skrillex. And I was like, all right. She's like, he's got a show next week. He's like, he's got a show in Chicago next week. You have to go meet him. And I was like, all right, cool. And immediately just him and his boy RH, who's like his road manager at the time. I was just like, fucking
you guys clicked.
It was just like it was like peanut butter and jelly
forever bros.
Yeah, it was like it was so sick. It was like one of those things that like validates your like that your humanity. Like it was like fucking I was just so amped on the both of those dudes. Just like their energy was just so fucking cool. And I was like that's it, bro. I was like, I get it and I'm down. And I worked really hard for them for a long time and I met their whole team.
And this is what, in 11?
This is 2011.
Yeah.
And we got a And I,
you guys have accomplished a shitload in 2 years then.
Yeah, it's been
fucking crazy.
It's been a really fun ride.
Yeah.
And, so that, and then like after that, it was just game over. I was like, they were people that I always wanted to work with and I knew that. And they were people that would push me and like keep me like in a different, I don't want to even say like I knew they would take me places or anything like that. It was just like, I fucking loved working with those people. I felt appreciated. I felt really, really appreciated by them at that point. And I felt like they valued me and,
great when you can work together and everyone values everyone. When it's coming from both sides and no one feels like they're taking advantage or getting taken advantage of, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it was also like it's rare unless you're a doctor, or a lawyer to watch somebody change somebody's life, like on a daily basis. And fucking, like, say what you want about his music. Some people love it. Some people hate it.
Ben has a Skrillex tattoo.
It's music that doesn't necessarily appeal to the widest spectrum of fans, but, like...
It is a huge spectrum, though.
Even if it's not
a wide spectrum, there's a lot of motherfuckers that...
That's what I'm saying. And no one fucks with their fans like Sonny fucks with their fans. Like, he is 100%... His soul is in what he's doing. Like, it's like his... He's fucking like he's just like invests his whole being into that. And when people put that kind of thing into their art and into their work, you affect people, you change people, and you can change their life. And that is like you can't really ask for more than that. You know, I'm a rap head from way back. I always will be. I still am. But like when I had the opportunity to work for somebody that I literally know was going to fucking change the way people think about popular music and gives people that fucking feeling in their stomach when you hear that song, you're like, that is my shit. Like working for somebody that I still fucking get chills when I think about it, to be honest with you, working for somebody like that, whose fucking sole intent in life is to give people that fucking gut feeling. That is my shit. And that's I always want to be associated with people like that. And I always want to be able to do that professionally.
That's awesome. That was a great speech. I feel like that could have been an end of a movie.
Sorry.
No, that was great. How did you guys decide to go into business together with Ausla?
Basically, as things took off, like he was just like, I was always in the mix, like always being like, what can I do? What can I do? I want to do more. Like, show me this, teach me this, show me that. And the conversation just came up and they're like, we're doing a label and we're definitely going to need people to like put in sweat equity. Like they're like, we're looking at, you know, we were hoping you and Catherine could become partners in the label, and granted it's not going to be
sweat equity. What does that mean? Just work?
It's just work. Yeah, but like
leave some skin in the game.
Yeah. And I have, and, but like also like I own a percentage of the company.
Right.
Know? It's never, at that point it hadn't been profitable. Record labels take a long time to like really generate a lot of capital. But I invested a lot of time and personal labor and interest. A lot of my personal interest went into this company with the people that I ran it with. And he was like, I think that you guys bring something to the table. And I was like, cool, let's do it. And I, again, like back in the office working 12-hour days. But it took off like immediately. It was fucking everywhere. And it was like, it felt so good to be like, it still does. Like I'm so into it.
Well, I've been following you on Twitter for a while and I've we used to exchange emails back in the day, whether you remember or not. But the point is that I've known who you are for a while, but I didn't realize like that you were so tied in with that until like only a couple weeks ago when I saw you post a picture on Twitter of like a fucking 5 million sold plaque hanging in your office. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the Instagram flex.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try not to, but like, I, like if you told me like...
Dude, come on. Like, you got to post that on Instagram.
Like that was my... Dude, I remember reading an article in The Source back when I subscribed to The Source, and it was like, I remember knowing, finding out what an A&R was. And I was like, that's what's up. And like, I was like...
That's still like what I want to do. Like, that would be awesome, you know?
I couldn't believe it. And like, so I had this... Like, now like the label that we run is like... And the guy I work for, I'm his A&R for our label. And like, I work on A&R stuff with him. Like... He sold 5 fucking million records. I couldn't fucking believe
it. It's crazy.
That. Like, and then that just blows my mind. Yeah. It's not something that I like to different. Like, I think all my whole shit is pretty integrated, but online it might not come across as much because I really enthuse over rap online. Mostly Drake. Like, I'm basically just tweeting about Drake 12 hours a day. But I mean, anybody in LA or anybody that's around me knows that I fuck with Sonny on a very personal level and a very, very much a professional capacity too.
Yeah, yeah. I know like we're kind of running long, but I know we're all both on our way to other places. But if we have time, I would love to like kind of break down for kids who might be interested in going into publicity or who think like that sounds like an interesting route. If you could break down like what exactly you guys do, because we haven't really talked about that at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like in that, like the curation of the business, like how you guys decide which artists you want to pick up on, et cetera, et cetera.
Basically there's a lot to it. But in its essential form, a publicist is like the conduit through which information flows from an artist to the public. And we're basically, a means of communication, visually and informatively, through the public. So, I mean, that's in like a grand,
on a more specific level, like
specifically, I send emails to people who write about music.
Right. And you guys are the ones, you know about the music that the artist is putting out, and you're the ones telling like, oh, hey, I go to Pigeons and Planes. You know what I mean? Like, hey, yeah. Jake, like this song came out. If you like it, you know, whatever.
Exactly. And I'll be like, a lot of my shit now is like online exclusives. Like everybody wants exclusive content. So I'm like, yo, I have this video. I want to premiere it with you. Can we time that? Yada, yada, yada. Oh, and then like, oh, like fucking for lack of a better example, Skrillex is going to be in New York Times. Do you want to write a piece about this show that's going to happen and drop it like 3 days before it happens? Like, I'll let you talk to him. I'll give you these exclusive photos. We'll set that up. Yo, Spin Magazine, fucking what happened? Like, the best example in Sonny's career is like, yo, Spin Magazine, fucking this kid is selling out 8,000 person rooms. You've never even written a word on him. He should be on your cover. Like, that was a Catherine kill. That was when something she set up. Basically, like being like iterating to the people that generate media, iterating to them ideas and framing them contextually so that it makes sense for their publication. Spin fucking put fucking Kurt Cobain on the cover. You know, there was like grunge wasn't like the shit. Like, it wasn't like selling tons of records at that point. Sonny wasn't like a thing. Like, he was, but it wasn't like it is now, you know? He wasn't like TMZ.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but the Spin cover was like, they were like, this is important, and we're going to be the first people to tell a fucking huge audience that this is super fucking important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's publicity. That's what mm-hmm. publicity does. To a certain point, and now it's my job to call TMZ and be like, yo, take down that photo. That's bullshit. You know? At a certain time, you become defense.
Right.
For a lot of my clients. That's how you know you made it.
Right. Do you have to, like, keep some of your artists in check? Like, hey, man, you shouldn't be saying that on Twitter and shit.
Absolutely.
Like that?
Yeah? Absolutely. Catherine Fraser is the best at that. She's like like life coach. And
so you guys also kind of decide what is a good look and bad look for your artists.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
We just frame their aesthetic within the public perception.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many emails would you estimate that you send a day?
On some days, like let's say like one day this week, I sent around probably 13,000.
13,000 emails.
We're servicing major like lists of major people.
Like, yeah, you're pressing a button that's automating. How many do you think that you're actually like typing per day? Because I bet that's
hundreds,
still a shit ton.
Hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. I'm receiving over 500 emails a day now.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you guys go about deciding who you want to fuck with?
It's a lot of things. I mean, a lot of the times it's people who need it, like people who are already blowing up and are that need direction, things like that. Those are some examples. A lot of times you get on the ground floor with people like this kid, Alexander Spitt from LA, I've known for years. I knew him in SF when he was in a group called Instant Messengers.
Speaking yeah, we've already had him on.
That's what's up. Yeah, I mean, like, I had been harping on fucking Alexander Spitt for years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this shit is dope. And then I had an opportunity to be his publicist and, like, kind of take him to the next level in terms of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
But no one, I mean, it's like, not like no one knew, but, like, you know, he's much more on the, the national radar now at this point. And he's only getting better, and his music's taking it to the next level. So
yeah, absolutely. Shout
it's like
out
people
to
that, I fuck with you spit, you know that. But it's like, yeah, like if you see the potential in people, and that's where really where I think that my future in the music industry lies is I think that is like discovering people when they're much younger, and A&R is essentially what that's a key component of it. But I've also recently thought about it, and I think that like I'm attracted to potential across like every aspect of my life, like not what something is, but what something could be and how I can help. And like that is my shit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my interpersonal relationships, my professional relationships, my work, myself. Like I want to make myself better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're kind of involved in Weird Twitter. Let's talk about that real briefly before we get out of here.
Oh, yeah. So what is Weird Twitter?
I mean, Weird Twitter, it's like fucking Chippy and Brittany are the queens of Weird Twitter.
No, I fuck with hella people on Twitter, but I don't like, it's just like real life. Like I have like a lot of friends, you know, and I do my own little thing. But I have like internet friends, and Conrad's actually one of my favorite. Shout out Conrad.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be hanging out with Conrad tonight. We'll probably see you at the show.
He's good on Twitter, you know? I respect people. It's communication.
Conrad is the king of jumping into Twitter conversations.
No doubt. What I was saying, exactly what I was saying earlier is like my shit is like, I love communicating with people. I've always done that. I was always getting kicked out of class for talking too much. You can't talk to more people at once than you can with Twitter. And that's why I think Twitter is really amazing. And there's like such an amazing like array of people that to talk to. And I try not to have enemies. Like I think I can only have two people that are, two people that are like fuck Clayton, but like most people I feel like I'm on pretty good terms with, and I love that, and I can appreciate everybody. I try to, and I think that like Twitter, I think that's really what I love about the internet, is that it's like it's just a forum to like just hang out with all your homies.
Hell yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
so Weird Twitter is like, that's one of my little Twitter things.
Yeah,
but I'm also down with like, I also talk to like hella rappers on Twitter.
Mm.
I also talk to like hella, like, dude, the most of my followership is Skrillexicans, Mexican Skrillex fans.
We
crazy.
Found out the power of Skrillexic, or not Skrillexicans, but I found out the power of the Skrillex army because we had Penny on the show, and Skrillex tweeted one tweet about a video, and all of a sudden it went from like 1,000 views to 100,000 views overnight. And I was like, wow, this motherfucker is really influential. That shit was crazy. So yeah, shout out to Skrillex. That was like one of the dopest things that happened in the podcast was one single tweet. So
yeah, man.
Yeah, so I fucks with you guys. But thank you for coming on, dude.
Thank you. This has been fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's nice to get to talk about yourself sometimes, because I'm sure you're like a very polite person that usually lets people talk about themselves, you know?
I just like talking.
Yeah.
About all kinds of shit.
Yeah. No, but it was great, and I think it was very informative, and you know, maybe you fucking inspired some kids, and you know, your story was interesting.
That's so heavy, bro. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Well,
I hope so.
Yeah. You're an influencer now, man. Get used to it.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. I will be seeing you around, obviously. Tell the people where they can find you online.
You can, I'm on Twitter as Young Groupon, but Young like Young.
Amazing,
John.
Amazing Twitter name.
That was given to me by Dana Meyerson. Shout out Dana Meyerson. It's Y-U-N-G Groupon. And that's, you know, I'm on Instagram too. So hit me.
All right, man. This was kind of neat. My name is Lee. You guys might know me as Intuition. You can find me at It's Intuition on Twitter. Shout out to my man, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, base with two S's. You can find us together at That's Kind of Neat, and everything is wrapped up in a pretty package on kindofneat.net. So thank you to Clayton. How do you say your last name?
Blaha, B-L-A-H-A.
It's phonetic. That's what I figured, but I didn't want to say it wrong. So thank you to Clayton Blaha. This was kind of neat.
Dude, thank you.